I'm Natalie Gochner, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center. I'm joined on the left by State Senator Jim DeBacchus. Welcome, Jim.
Good morning, Natalie.
And we are so happy to welcome Chris Blake back to the show, political guru and represents the right.
Good morning.
Hi, Chris. We should also mention that Chris is the president of the Utah Charter School Association. You know, I just want to start out the show today by mentioning that I got this awful tweet earlier this week, just to kind of set this up. It was from the Washington Post, and the tweet simply read, "Two former Utah attorney generals charged with felonies, arrested this morning." It was just a sobering tweet to see that come from the Washington Post. I felt like I was in Louisiana, Chicago? I mean, this doesn't happen in Utah. We were all expecting it. Jim, break this down for us. What does this mean?
Well, there was no joy. I mean, I was not fist pumping. I was not happy. I was embarrassed. I would make a terrible juror. I mean, I thought about Mark, and I thought about his family, and I thought about his situation, and I thought about 30 years in prison, and, you know, it was not for me. There was just no joy in the process or what's happened. And as far as I'm concerned, Mr. Swallow and Mr. Shurtleff are going to have their day in court, and hopefully they're going to have great attorneys, and that will be what that will be. But the big issue, the elephant in the room, where we are not going and where we have been deafeningly silent as a state, we simply and absolutely refuse to talk about the culture of pay-to-play, which comes up again and again and again and again, and we pretend it's not there. We are a corrupt state as long as we have pay-to-play. And I hope that the arrest of our two former attorney generals will throw a little cold water and get the Republicans out of their sloganeering about, and they just go on and on, about excuses on why pay-to-play is okay. There's only three states in the United States of America, including Louisiana, that don't have campaign limitations. And it is perfectly legal. And this is a nonpartisan issue. Look, if we had a Democratic governor, you would have a governor's ball, and you would have $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000,
$60,000 checks. Same cast of characters.
Rolling in and giving whoever the governor is a pat on the back and giving them a check. These are people that have contracts with the state of Utah, and it's perfectly legal. And there's a whole army of people that work on campaigns that go and knock on the doors of these people that are doing business with the state. It is dirty. It's wrong. And the least you can say about it is it gives the perception of being dirty. And clearly sometimes it goes over the line past the perception. But it is a honeypot. It's easy money. Checks roll in. And legislators are woeful to turn it down and to go out and have to get money the old-fashioned way from their constituents. Until the pressure gets greater on legislators to take money from their constituents than the benefit they enjoy out of getting money from PACs and special interests and corporations and the rest, we're going to have the same system. So it's in the public hands.
Interesting.
Now.
Interesting. Chris, you have been at the center of political power in this state. Didn't you work for two different speakers?
I did, yes.
Yeah, right, the right-hand person for two different speakers. And, you know, I find myself saying when you're close to power, money comes into that equation. You know, a lot of people with money want to come be near that power. And I look at particularly Mark Shurtleff, who's someone I worked with early on, and he was a fine public servant doing all sorts of, you know, good things for this state, but somehow he got closer and closer and closer to crossing that line. Now, we don't know, you know, the full details and all those sorts of things, and he certainly made a huge contribution to this state. But what is it when you're up in the Capitol that takes you from being, you know, very pure when it comes to how you handle money and power and to getting too close to the line?
Well, that's a deep philosophical question, Natalie, and an interesting one. And I'm not sure that I have any strong or profound answers to share in terms of that. I think we have mostly and largely fine public servants
Absolutely.
That do understand how to deal and understand their ethical responsibilities as it relates to interacting with those with money, with those that are want to donate to a campaign. The problem I have with Jim's assertion on these that this is the problem is, first off, we see John and Mark have been indicted and accused of a number, a litany of different felonies. And Sim and Troy Rawlings made the point that there are others that could come or others that they could have proved. But most of them are not really dealing with the issue of campaign contributions and the unlimited nature. You started by saying, well, we're not Illinois. You know, we're not Chicago. Mm-hmm. Well, Chicago has campaign contributions. So does that make them more holy or more pure than what you see in Utah? And so this concept that people are going to give money, there's a the Supreme Court has decided, rightly or wrongly, you know, if I'm sure Jim has strong feelings on this, that money is a form of speech. And we see people giving unlimited amounts now in all sorts of different fashions. So you can abhor or dislike the influence of money in politics. It's always been there, and it always will. And so I think what Utah has done rightly is they have put transparency on those contributions. If you don't like somebody giving a $10,000 contribution and think that's improper or buys influence, well, that's going to be disclosed, and it's going to be disclosed within a certain period of time. And then you can judge for yourself, that's inappropriate. I don't like that. Mm-hmm. So that's where I have trouble that, you know, if you give $1,000, that's pure and okay. If you give $5,000, that's inappropriate. And it just seems, doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, interesting. You have any follow-up on that, Jim? I know that you have some frustration that you see candidates that actually have not a single person that's given them money, and it's all come from corporations.
So you look at and I have a little chart here that my folks put together. This is a representative who raised $43,000 in the last reporting period. 42% from special interests, 23% from corporations, 27% from PACs, and two people. Here's another leader from Weber County. 52% from corporations, 19% from PACs, 17% from special interest, 8 people. I mean, and I can go down the list, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars. And there is a line waiting from people who have special interest before the legislature. And they've got checks, and they're giving them to you. If you somehow are naive enough to believe that if somebody gives you a check, and you're getting no checks from any people, not from constituents at all, that doesn't have an influence on legislation, I believe you're very, very naive.
And I guess where I dispute this with Jim is because somebody, an individual, for example, gives money, a constituent or not, doesn't mean that person doesn't have an interest, mm-hmm. That they might be trying to influence in the same way. And so, yeah, I understand. But yet, these companies that give still don't get their way on Capitol Hill on 100% of the issues.
But they
and
don't.
There are conflicting issues that have
that
to be discussed and debated.
On both sides of the aisle, we won't settle campaign finance reform or figure that out. But what is it that went wrong here? Like Chris, what, you know, Jim said campaign, you know, this is pay-to-play culture. I want to change that. What would you change?
And I think this is that's a better, much better discussion on this. I don't see pay-to-play as it relates to campaign contributions as the problem with Swallow and Shurtleff.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, recognizing they'll get their day in court. They clearly stepped over the line, and I think they were just unethical as it relates to their responsibilities, as it relates to their ability to investigate people. And that's the issue here we should be looking at. Should our attorney general be elected or appointed? Would that make a difference, you know, as they administer the law?
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. In our next segment, we'll talk about leadership races.
This is Jim DeBacchus on the left.
From the right, filling in for Greg Hughes, Chris Blake.
And Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. I just want to remind our listeners that I take the best ideas from both Chris and Jim and kind of merge them into problem solving, and we get things done in this community. We ended up the last segment by just really Chris pointing out that, you know, maybe the issue with our current quagmire in the Attorney General's office has dealt with the fact that they are political offices when maybe they should be appointed. And I just want to throw out the same thing from the standpoint of a district or county attorney. You know, it doesn't seem like enforcing the law is a partisan issue. And it brings all sorts of strange dynamics. I mean, we have, you know, Mark Shurtleff, you know, basically saying that Sim Gill's doing this for political reasons, and Sim Gill kind of saying, well, then what was your House, you know, Republican, you know, commission doing when they were looking at you and came to the same conclusions? I mean, it just throws out all these odd dynamics. I just will go ahead and say, though, that I'm not a particularly partisan person. I think that sometimes partisan ideologies get in the way of doing the right thing. And I would love it to have an attorney general that's appointed by a statewide elected official like the governor and a district attorney that runs but not in a partisan race. Chris, your comments on that.
Yeah, I think it's an area of concern from, if you will, a conservative point of view. I'm always concerned about the administration of justice. It should be done in a fair, impartial manner. And we've seen in this country, on both sides of the aisle, people use...
Great line there.
Thank you. People use their political positions as a prosecutor, as an attorney general, to create media headlines for themselves, and then use it to turn to run for governor or senator or something else. And that, to me, concerns me. It's not something I want to see. If somebody has broken the law, they should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. But it shouldn't be done for a political purpose. So if we're going to do, you know, the perp walk and walk somebody out to a police car for a headline, that's where I get really concerned. And often those that are in an elected position have maybe some incentive to create that so people know what they're doing. I'm not saying it's always negative, but it could be, and
yeah,
something we need to watch.
This particular case has the feel of some grandstanding. I'll just say that. You know, I'll say it from the district attorney's office. There just seems to be too much fascination with the media instead of just getting the job done. Jim, that might be a controversial statement to you.
Couldn't disagree with you more. I mean,
so.
There has been a professionalism and a meticulousness and an aura of making sure everything is done right. This is a joint prosecution by the Republican Davis County attorney. And as for... should Mr. Shurtleff and Swallow have been allowed some kind of other procedure? I think the county has a policy, and it's clear what the policy is. You get arrested, X, Y, and Z happens, and it happens to everybody. And to have broken that policy and given the ex-attorney generals special treatment, given what they're charged with, which is special treatment, would have been a grievous mistake and would have shown the very thing that is being charged. They went into the system just like everybody else. They were picked up just like everybody else. They were booked just like everybody else. They walked down that same ramp the way everybody else does. And you know what? In America, that's the way it ought to be. There shouldn't have been a backroom deal where they didn't face what every single other person arrested in Salt Lake County.
You disagree at all there, Chris?
Nope.
Don't disagree. Great. Well, let's move on to another issue and something that could be kind of fun to talk about. It's really speculative, but it's getting to be more and more of the political season as November approaches, election time. And we've got leadership races in the legislature, Senate and House, Republican and Democrat. We have a Capitol Hill guru here in Chris Blake. And Chris, I wondered if you could just break down for our listeners what happens in leadership races. Why are they so important? Why do we look at it? What are the cast of characters that we're looking at this time around?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are critically important elections. Shortly after the November election, all of the individual caucuses, House Democrats, House Republicans, Senate Democrats, Senate Republicans, will meet together as a caucus to elect the folks that will represent them among the legislature. I mean, you can't have 75 people and 29 people making every decision. So they as a caucus, as a group, elect their leaders to negotiate one with another and bring back a package to say, this is what we negotiate and what we discuss. So
do they go to a hotel to do this? Do they do it up on the Hill?
It's varied over the years. Mostly, and I'm most familiar with House Republicans, because that's where I was for a number of years. They would meet in their caucus room at the Capitol, meet as a group. Almost always everyone is there. There's a procedure if somebody's not to allow them to vote. But they hear quick speeches from each of the candidates for the different offices, start with the Republicans always start with the highest level, either Speaker or President, that they'll ultimately elect, and then Majority Leader, Majority Whip, and Majority Assistant Whip, and move down the aisle there. It's a majority rules, so 50% plus one. They vote by secret ballot, and they'll hear short speeches and then vote on those races. It'll be counted and announced to the caucus and then shortly to the public. And so it's an interesting dynamic. It's one of the few times, if the maybe the only time, that those groups vote by secret ballot, because every other vote that they make is public and is on the record. And so, but it's an important election, but one that they make to elect their individual leaders that will represent them on the Capitol.
Is there more than one round? If that somebody doesn't get 50%, how does it work?
Yeah, everyone votes. So it certainly could be if you have four candidates, they'll start narrowing it down and knock one off at a time until
you
get
majority.
To the final two and then have a final vote.
You know,
vote.
Nolan Karras, who was a former speaker and had both won and lost in that role, has this famous line about how after the election was over, he didn't know how many thank you notes to write because there were so many private commitments to vote for him. But you never know what they did.
He wrote 38 for 32 votes, right? 38 thank you notes. So
pretty crazy. But tell us about the cast of characters that we may be looking at.
Well, certainly in the House, on the House Republican side, with Speaker Lockhart stepping down, you basically have every seat open. So Representative Dee, who's the current majority leader, and Representative Hughes, who's the current majority whip, and whom I'm filling in for, appear likely to both run for speaker. You have Representative Don Ipsen from St. George, who's the assistant whip, looking to move up. Representative Dunnigan, who chaired the Special Investigative Committee and has run for leadership before, is considering running for majority leader. And then you'll have a number of people running for those down ballot spots who think that they have something to offer. And so it should be wild and crazy. The Senate may not be quite as wild, but if Senator Ralph Okerlund, who's the current majority leader, decides not to run, that could make a few dominoes fall as well.
A lot of Republican talk there, Jim.
No, but I find it interesting. What if you run, if you shoot to be king or queen as a speaker and you don't win, you don't get a shot at number two. You're out in the back bench sitting up in this is a high stake kind of thing.
Absolutely. The Republican rules have been, and certainly they could change them, but have been, if you run for a position, you get one opportunity. So if you run for speaker, that's the one. You don't get a drop down. If you run for majority leader, you run for majority leader. And so you get you pick your spot, and that's where you're at.
So what are they doing now? What are the candidates for speaker? I noticed Brad Dee has raised a lot of money, and there's a lot of contributions going from Brad Dee's money pot out to various legislators. That's part of the game, I guess.
Well, I think what they're doing now is they're certainly trying to build consensus, like you do with any piece of legislation. You're out talking to your colleagues, you're giving your vision as to why they think they should vote for you. And then as well, you're helping support campaigns and you're helping them get elected. And that might be people that are in difficult seats. It might be people that are challenging incumbents of the other party. So they're looking at how can they help get people elected.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I represent the political center. I'm joined on the left by State Senator Jim DeBacchus and on the right by Chris Blake, the president of the Utah Charter Schools Association. Really interesting, you guys, breaking this down. What do we think is going to happen? And I'm going to ask Jim this because you can talk with more flair about what's happening on the Republican side. And I think that Chris needs to be a little bit more careful there.
Well, I think it's going to be a good fight, a good battle. Going to be a good. You got
Mel Brown.
Yeah, Mel Brown is. He won't get in unless he's pretty sure he can win. He's pretty. He's
careful.
Wise.
He's smart.
Yeah, he's careful, and I don't know that the votes are there for him. But look, this is the other body. I don't really understand them. You know, it's a lot of locusts over there, and there's just millions of them. But it'll probably get down to Greg Hughes and Brad Dee, and they will look at it and say, who do we want? I think Brad Dee is more a kind of administrator kind of guy. Greg is more verbal, more a little more touch-eyed, more ideological, a little more flair. It will be interesting to see how the Republicans want to be represented in public and how they want to get the sausage made.
Yeah.
They're two worthy opponents.
Yeah, that's where I was going to go, Jim. It is really wonderful for the citizens that we have such high caliber people running for these offices. And I think even in the D. Hughes kind of lineup, two that will likely challenge each other for the House Speaker. A really good relationship there. Am I right there, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. And the point I would make is it is going to be a close election. If you look back on the history of contested speaker, they're always close. It's 1, 2, 3 votes that are going to decide this. I don't see that being any different this time. And that's what you get when you get good candidates.
Yeah, and we'll start the post-Lockhart era.
Yes.
What part does geography play in this? I mean, you always hear about the Utah County block, and you hear about the rural, and you hear what is that dynamic, or is this so personality-driven that it isn't as big an issue?
You know, I think it plays an aspect, but not as big a one as some people like to make it seem. You know, yes, they might, the block might want somebody to represent them because these people are going to be making decisions and bring those back. So they want to make sure their interests are heard, just like, you know, the citizens of Provo want the best person to represent them in Provo. But yeah, ultimately it's a personality driven, it's a one-on-one kind of building exercise.
One more question for you, Chris, and this one's just because you're the guy that would know this, but how close was it last time when Speaker Lockhart upset Dave Clark?
As I said earlier, they're all within a vote or two, and that's exactly the case here.
Interesting. Wow. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. We need to cover a couple other issues. Let's do these quickly, and let's just go through these. Recently, Utah was awarded the number one state for business. I think it's the third year in a row from the Palina Group. Do you agree with that, Jim?
You know what? There was a very wise man that once said, no other success can compensate for failure in the home. And I have had it up to here with us pinning awards on ourselves on what a great business state we are. You know what? The purpose of state government is first, second, third, and fourth, education. And when we get an award for being number one in education instead of 50th, then I will be proud.
And David O. McKay will smile at us. Am I getting the guy right that said that?
Yeah, you are.
Chris?
I'm going to poke Jim and just say, you know, we're the number one state for business and don't have campaign contributions. So clearly we're doing something right. But in all seriousness.
For business.
Yeah. But in all seriousness, I think it is a good thing. Because it is talking about people. If we don't have full employment or a place where people can get a job and people can be secure and raise their families, then it's not going to be a good place for business. It's not going to be a good place for people. And so it's an award that talks about the infrastructure, the opportunity that's available here in Utah.
That's great. We need to go to our gripes. And I hope you've come prepared with one, Chris. We'll go to Jim first just because he's always got a gripe. And that might give you a chance to think about what you're mad about, Chris.
My gripe is that... thinking of one here. My gripe is that we're working so hard to turn a bunch of decisions over to the Air Quality Commission, which really has a tremendous amount to say about air pollution in our community. On that Air Quality Commission, a representative for Tesoro, a representative for Kennecott, a representative for the Utah Manufacturers Association, the Utah Petroleum Association, give me a break.
And Jim, I just have to say to you that those are some of the people that can help fix this. Why don't you
them
on that?
Yeah, right. And let's put the inmates running the prison board, too, because they really know things from the inside.
I'm very proud of Rio Tinto's record in this area. But go ahead, Chris, your gripe.
My gripe is going to be today that I want to see resolution brought to the SEA waiver. We see that the state school board, the governor, the legislature are all getting involved in this. Common Core gets wrapped into this. I want to see this debate put to bed. I think it's important that we have high standards in education and that we push our students towards higher and greater opportunity. And this whole debate, which I find it just a distraction, I want to see it resolved. So however it needs to get resolved, resolve it, and let's move forward with educating our kids.
Yeah, amen. You know, my gripe deals with news that we got in the last week or so about the $1 billion-plus property tax error. I'm looking for nods to make sure, yeah, I see some eyes rolling. You know, I worked as an economist in state government for 16 years. I know the people really well that do, that crunch the numbers. I feel like I know the tax code pretty well and have a pretty good feel for public finance. And, you know, one of the principles in public finance is simplicity. Make the tax code easy to comply and easy to enforce. And it's just a reminder to elected officials, people that make laws, that you either got to simplify things or you got to give more resources to understanding them. Because when we have $1 billion-plus error in our property taxes, that's an embarrassment.
What business would have an employee or employees left that made $1 billion mistake? I mean, this is, you're absolutely right now.
Well, and kudos to State Auditor John Dougal, who has been as aggressive as he said he would be and looking at the numbers and displaying facts and letting people make decisions accordingly. I agree with you. We need a predictable system, and maybe that's what the problem is here.
Yeah, and behind every great elected official, there's a great analyst, David Stringfellow, that probably helped him find
exactly,
that number.
Exactly.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I hope you've enjoyed the conversation. I've been joined by Chris Blake on the right and Jim DeBacchus on the left. I'm Natalie Gochner. Tyler Ford produces the program. Thanks for listening.